The kitchen was hot and bright from the western sun streaming through the wide windows. Dallas threw her library books on the table and, without thinking, quickly lowered the bamboo blinds. Then she stopped and stood still. Funny that her mother had left them up. "Mum! Mum! Are you home?" Dallas's voice echoed through the house, and instinctively she knew that it was empty. Then she noticed the melted butter on the kitchen counter, the half-eaten sandwich, and the cup of cold coffee. She must have been in the kitchen at least 5 minutes before she saw the note. The sun had probably blinded her eyes, but there it was, a piece of yellow paper, partly hidden by the sugar bowl on the kitchen table. In her mother's round, almost childish handwriting, she read, "Dearest, I'm at the hospital. Dad taken sick. Come over if you want to. Mum." Dallas read the note several times. "Come over if you want to." Took a few minutes to sink in. "Dad taken sick. Dad taken sick." She grabbed her handbag and ran out the door. The hospital was an easy walk from Dallas's house along a pretty tree-lined suburban street. Despite the heat of the August afternoon, she ran. It was a long uphill climb to where the hospital sprawled on a summit overlooking the village. Halfway up, Dallas had to slow down to catch her breath. "Dad taken sick." The words made a nagging rhythm in her head. Why hadn't he come home? Why was he in the hospital? Sick didn't sound like an accident. In all her life, her father had never been sick except for one bout with the flu several winters before. Just this past Sunday, the day before yesterday, he had beaten her in two sets of tennis, and she had thought, as she did so often, how lucky she was to have a father who was so much fun. He wasn't like some of the fathers she knew, someone who came home from work and settled down to watch the news without paying any attention to his teenage kids, except to complain. Last evening, after supper, he had taken her and mother to a special place to look for blackberries. They'd picked a large basket full, and someone suddenly remembered that she and her mother had planned to make jam that afternoon. The basket of blackberries had been sitting on the kitchen floor, and she wondered if her mother had time to buy the sugar. Outside the hospital, Dallas hesitated. She didn't know whether to go up the steps to the main entrance or go around the side where the sign pointed to emergency. She decided on the main entrance, and she went directly to the information desk. "My father, Mr. Henry Davis, is in the hospital, but I don't know where. He may be in emergency. I think he came in a few hours ago." "I'll call emergency and see if he is there." The woman behind the desk looked at her with sympathetic eyes. "Was there an accident?" "Oh, I don't know. I don't think so. My mother's note at home said sick." After speaking on the phone for a minute or two, the woman nodded her head. "Yes, he is in emergency. Go down the first corridor, then take the left and keep walking. You'll see the desk there."
"Did they say what it is?"
Dallas asked.
"No, you'll find out," the woman said kindly. Dallas walked swiftly down the long corridor. She averted her head when she saw a figure wrapped in blankets wheeled out the elevator on a stretcher. She hadn't gotten as far as the desk when her mother came running up to her.
"Dallas, Dallas!" Her mother threw her arms around her and held her close. "It's awful, it's just awful." Dallas held on to her mother and tried to quiet her sobs.
"I'm all right. I'm really been all right. I'm just so glad you're here," her mother sobbed. "I was just going to call the house."
"I was at the library. Tell me what happened." Dallas led her mother to a bench where they could both sit down.
They called me from his office, Mrs. Davis finally spoke in a quiet voice and looked at her daughter. He had a heart attack, darling. I almost can't believe it. He's so young, only 41. But that should be in his favour, shouldn't it? She looked at Dallas pleadingly, asking for assurance.
I guess so.
Dallas felt stunned.
How could he have a heart attack? Just like that, out of the blue. He's always been so healthy.
I know, and he's done all the right things. I mean, he took care of himself, and I took care of him. I thought he'd live to be 100.
But, Mum, he's not going to die. Lots of men have heart attacks and go on living. He's strong, he's young, he's healthy. Mum, he can't die.
People die, Dallas. Mrs. Davis spoke softly. Her face was stricken with pain and she closed her eyes.
What did the doctor say? Where is he now? What are they doing for him? Can I see him?
Dallas asked one question after another, not waiting for the answers.
He's still in the emergency room. I think they're going to take him to intensive care. The doctor doesn't say anything. He says they're doing everything they can.
He's in an oxygen tent. He's unconscious, darling. Her mother gripped her hand hard.
I'm afraid he's in a coma. Mum, he's going to be all right. He has to be. He just has to be.
Dallas held her mother's hand between her own. They sat there, waiting. They waited through the night. At various times, the doctors came out to speak to them. Once, Dallas persuaded her mother to go out for a sandwich and coffee. Another time, Dallas brought up more coffee and sandwiches. Once, her mother was allowed to go into intensive care to see her husband. And she came out looking like death itself. In the early hours of the morning, Dallas begged to be able to see her father. A nurse led Dallas through the long corridors and then into the deadly quiet room. Her father was on a bed, flat on his back, enclosed in a transparent tent with a tube attached to his arm and a machine making a frightening, erratic ticking as it monitored his heartbeat.
Dad! Daddy!
Dallas whispered softly. But the figure on the bed made no response. His eyes were closed and his breathing was hard. Dallas stood as close as she could get, looking at him. She was aching to bend down to kiss him, but she knew she could not. She felt that if she concentrated hard enough, he would know that she was there. In a few minutes, the nurse tapped on her shoulder and said the time was up. Dallas didn't want to go back to her mother, but she was afraid that her father was dying, and she wanted to be alone and try and digest the thought. How could a person be alive and well one day and the next be dying? It was too frightening to grasp. Her father's parents, her grandparents, were healthy and active. How could their son be dying? Old people died, not someone young and strong like her father. But he did. At 7:20 in the morning, the doctor came into the waiting room. Dallas knew the minute she saw his face what he had come to tell them. He nodded his head at their questioning faces. I'm sorry. We did everything we could for him. He wasn't in pain. He died quietly. Do you want to see him? Mrs. Davis nodded her head. They followed the doctor down the corridors again. He didn't look any different in death, except that there was no tent or tube or machines. Dallas had never seen a dead person before, and she was almost afraid to look at her father. But he looked exactly the same. His face was still suntanned. She remembered how he had taken off his hat on the tennis court on Sunday, saying he wanted to get more sun. And she timidly bent down to kiss him. His forehead was warm. Her mother whispered to her, "Darling, do you mind? I'd like to be alone with him for a few minutes." Dallas squeezed her mother's hand and left her. She felt peculiar that she wasn't crying. She ought to be crying. Instead, her throat felt dry and choked up. She sat in the waiting room wondering what was wrong with her. It was as if she were trying to figure out what, instead of experiencing the feeling itself.
The only thing she felt was stunned. That afternoon, the house was crowded with friends and neighbours. Dallas kept herself busy pouring coffee, serving cake, answering the phone. And a few times she had thought, "My mother lost her husband, but no one seems to remember that I've lost my father." She'd gone into the bathroom and cried softly to herself, ashamed of the horrid thought. Maybe the loss was worse for her mother. But her father hadn't just been an ordinary father, and no one in the world, not even mother, knew of the special relationship they had had. She wanted to scream when one neighbour, someone she'd never liked anyway, said, "You'll have to take care of your mother now, Dallas. She'll be all alone." She hadn't one word of sympathy for Dallas's loss. Welcome to our seminar today, Grief, Hope and Help. And today we're going to be discussing bereavement as it pertains to children. In our seminar today, we will look at how separation affects different ages of children, the five stages involved in the grief process as specifically applied to children, communicating a loss to a child, and finally, helping a grieving child. Grief is a normal response to loss. Whenever a significant part of our life is removed, be it a person, a pet, or an object, grief is the natural and normal response. A child may grieve following divorce, the loss of a cherished object or place, the loss of siblings through marriage or leaving home for boarding school, the loss of security through parental fighting or separation, the loss of a pet, or a cherished dream or promise. Death, however, usually is the most difficult for many children both to comprehend and to cope through. Whatever the reason for the separation, the child very often blames himself. Sometimes he feels, "If only I had been a better person, my parents wouldn't have gotten a divorce," or, "I must have done something bad to have to live in a foster home," or, "My parents do not like me, or Daddy wouldn't have gone away." Separation affects different ages of children. It affects even the youngest infant to some degree. When an infant goes into foster care or is placed up for adoption, there is a period of time in which the child will withdraw and act despondent. He is often grieving the loss of his parents. This reaction is sometimes referred to as an anaclectic depression. He may even resist bonding to the new parents who are ready and willing to give him love and acceptance. Toddlers deal with separation by fantasizing. A child in foster care may say that his daddy is going to come back and get him, when in fact the father has actually deserted him permanently. A child whose parents have divorced may fantasize that they will get back together and love each other again. The most difficult age for a child to deal with separation and loss is between 6 and 12. This child has outgrown fantasy and yet is not able to understand separation and loss like an adolescent can. Often this child experiences many psychosomatic and interpersonal problems as well as problems at school. This child will typically turn most of his anger inward toward himself. If separation occurs while a child is an adolescent, the child may cope by intellectualizing. "Well, Mum and Dad couldn't get along anyway, and it's really for the best that they're getting a divorce, or that Dad's gone away," or whatever it may be. A teenaged child who has experienced frequent separations, or even one separation early in life, may have a more difficult time coping with all of the normal struggles of adolescence. Now, what do these stages of
grief and separation as they pertain specifically to children. The stages of separation include number one, denial, number two, anger, number three, depression, number four, bargaining, and number five, resolution. The key to helping a child progress through the stages of separation is communication and faith in God. The first stage of denial is the stage that says it can't be true. Mum and Dad did not get a divorce. I don't believe it. The next stage is one of anger. Why did my mum and dad do this to me? I'm so upset, so angry. And this stage, if it's not dealt with, could be prolonged for many years. The natural result of anger is depression. A child may feel there's no use in even trying. School-related, behavioural, psychosomatic, and interpersonal problems often are the result. The fourth stage is the stage of bargaining, which may be an attempt to bargain with God. God, if I do this, will you bring back my daddy? It will be bargaining with another family member or bargaining within the child's mind. The last stage, the resolution stage, is one that many children may never reach. Resolution occurs when the child accepts the fact that the separation has taken place and will not change. The only way to reach this point with the child is to retrace the previous steps through detailed communication and by helping the child to develop a trust that God is working the situation out for the best. Romans chapter 8 and verse 28 says, "And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God and to them who are called according to his purpose." And now for a few minutes we're going to divide into discussion groups and look at our first question. Our question is, should we tell children that a loved one has died or that there are there some appropriate euphemisms that we can use? Should we tell the children that a loved one has died, or are there appropriate euphemisms that we can use? Now we'll gather together in just a few more moments. Widows ask how to deal with their young children's bereavement. They are helpless parents here. The child specialists agree that children should not be protected from the knowledge of death, and unless one has a strong religious conviction to the contrary, they should not be told that daddy's simply gone to heaven. With all that is going on in heaven these days, no child can ever feel that that's an acceptable concept or ever was. A child should know about death as and when it has meaning for him. His question should be answered honestly and his father's absence talked about. When a child cries and says he wants his daddy, his mother can only say, "I would like to have him here too." If he never speaks of his father, his mother should not acquiesce to that silence with her own silence or consistently hide her tears. Talk. Equally, mothers have to avoid turning the child into a consistent companion and confidant, a comforting temptation for the lonely young widow. I started our seminar tonight by reading an excerpt from Hela Coleman's book, Sometimes I Don't Love My Mother, by Scholastic Books. In that book there, the story revolves around a teenage girl who becomes the sole focus of her mother's affection. A temptation for the lonely young widow is to make the child a constant companion and confidant. Even a six-year-old has his own life to live. So much is so basic. The news of the loss should be shared by the adult with whom the child is closest. If the child has a difficult relationship with his parents before a separation, then the separation is going to be harder for him to handle. The child must receive very prompt and specific information about the reasons for the separation or the loss, whether it's divorce or death or whatever it may be. The child must be allowed to participate in the family grieving process. The child needs to know, too, that he is not alone. That God has provided someone to be with him. Truly, God is a God of the fatherless, and he sets the lonely into families. Let me read from you Psalm 68 and verses 4 to 6. Psalm 68 verse 4 says, "Sing unto God, sing praises to his name. Extol him that rideth upon the heavens by his name Yah, and rejoice before him. A father of the fatherless and a judge of the widows is God in his holy habitation. God setteth the solitary in families. He bringeth out those which are in chains, but the rebellious dwell in a dry land." God setteth the solitary in families. At this point, affectionate hugs and touching communicate much more than words can. Ask the child what he has missed about the person he has been separated from in recent times. Encourage the child to talk about the person who has gone. Pictures and special memories can be very helpful in the healing process at this time. This is a crucial time to pray with the child about God's intervention and love for the child. The child should be asked, or should be allowed to ask questions and to talk freely about his feelings. A great deal goes on in little heads. Patient and careful listening cannot be overemphasized. Children have concrete concepts and take literally words like lost, return, watching you. After attending a picnic for widows with children under 12, one 8-year-old was very relieved to meet another girl whose father was also lost, in inverted commas. She admitted to her mother that, quote, "In school I always say my parents are divorced because I thought we were the only ones who couldn't find ours." A fatherless child may initially feel more deprived, more abandoned and fearful than his mother, that his mother might die. He needs to express his distress. Talking about it with his surviving parent is still the best of all therapies. It may take time and patience. If he senses that a subject is disturbing for his mother or other family members, he soon learns to keep his thoughts to himself. On the other hand, he need not be pitied. Pity carries a message of incompetence. It's a put-down. There is plenty of evidence to prove that single parents can be good child rearers, and that a child does not necessarily suffer psychological trauma because there is no father or mother in the home.